This is Dick Estelle's Radio Reader. I'm Bob Page. This is the last Radio Reader episode. Due to serious illness, Dick is retired from reading books for the public radio audience after over 50 years. Contact information to send your best wishes to Dick is available at the Radio Reader website, radioreader.net. Please stay tuned following this reading for a special message from Dick. In this final reading of John Grisham's Rogue Lawyer, published by Doubleday of New York in 2015, the murder trial of cage fighter Tadeo Zapata continues. Defense attorney Sebastian Rudd's expert witness, retired psychiatrist Dr. Tazelman, is being cross-examined by prosecutor Max Mancini as they watch the video of the fight where Zapata delivered fatal punches to referee Sean King. Now, doctor, you're telling this jury that they're looking at a man who knows he's doing wrong, violating the law, but cannot physically or mentally stop himself. Is that right? That's correct, Dr. Tazelman says, not yielding an inch. 13. 14. 15. Max counts the punches off slowly and stops at 20. Max calls out, "Now, at this point, Doc, is he still insane?" "He is, yes." 21, 22, and bodies land on Tadeo as Norberto finally dives on and stops the carnage. Max asks, "How about now, Doc? They've pulled him off, and the attack is over. At what point does the boy return to sanity?" "It's hard to say." "A minute later? An hour later?" "It's hard to say." "It's hard to say because you don't know, right? In your opinion, legal sanity is like a switch that flips on and off, rather conveniently for the defendant, right?" "That's not what I said." Max pushes a button and the screen disappears. The lights are brightened as everyone takes a breath. Max whispers to an assistant and picks up another legal pad covered with notes. He shuffles to the podium, glares at the witness, and asks, "What if he hit him 30 times, Dr. Tazelman? You'd still diagnose him as legally insane?" "Under the same set of facts, yes." "Oh, we're talking about the same facts. What about 40 times? 40 blows to the head of a man who's clearly unconscious. Still legally insane, Doc?" "Yes." "This defendant showed no signs of stopping after only 22. What if he landed 100 shots to the head, Doc? Still legally insane in your book?" Tazelman earns his money with, "The greater number of punches is clearly evidence of a deranged mind." Chapter 27. It's Friday afternoon, and there's no way we can finish the trial today. Like most judges, Go Slow likes to jumpstart the weekend and recesses early. As the jurors file out, Esteban Suarez glances my way one more time. It's as if he's still looking for the envelope. Bizarre. I spend a few minutes with Tadeo and recap the week. He still insists on taking the stand, and I tell him that will probably happen Monday morning. I promise to stop by the jail on Sunday and go through his testimony. I repeat my warning that it's never a good idea for the accused to testify. He's taken away in handcuffs. I spend a few minutes with his mother and family and answer their questions. I'm still pessimistic, but I try to hide it. Miguel follows me out of the courtroom and down a long hallway. When no one is listening, he says, "Suarez is waiting. Contact confirmed. He'll take the money." $10,000, I ask, just to make sure. "Si, senor." "Then go for it, Miguel, but just leave me out of it. I'm not bribing a juror." "I guess then, senor, that I need a loan." "Forget it. I don't make loans to clients, and I don't make loans that'll never be repaid. You're on your own, pal."
"But we took care of those two thugs for you."
I stop and glare at him. This is the first time he's mentioned Link's boys, Tubby and Razor. Slowly I say, "For the record, Miguel, I know nothing about those two. If you whacked them, you did it on your own." He's smiling and shaking his head.
No, senor, we did it as a favor for you. He nods to partner in the distance. He asked, we delivered. Now we need the favor returned. I take a deep breath and stare at a huge stained glass window the taxpayers paid for a century earlier. He has a point. Two dead thugs are worth more than 10 grand, at least in the currency of the street. The breakdown comes with a communication. I didn't request two dead thugs, but now that I benefit from their demise, am I obligated to return the favor? Suarez is probably wearing a wire and maybe even a camera. If the money can be traced to me, then I'm disbarred and headed for prison. I've had close calls before, and I prefer life on the outside. I swallow hard and say, sorry, Miguel, but I will not be involved. I turn and he grabs my arm. I shake him off as partner approaches. Miguel says, you'll be sorry, senor. Is that a threat? No, a promise. Chapter 28. There are fights tonight, but I've seen enough bloodshed for one week. I need to find another sport, and at the moment it happens to be chasing the most lovely Naomi Tarrant. Since we're still meeting on the sly, or at least afraid of being seen by someone who might recognize her as a teacher, we're visiting dark bars and low-end restaurants. Tonight we go to a new place, a Thai restaurant east of town, far away from the school where Naomi teaches starcher. We're confident we will not be seen by anyone we know. Not quite. Naomi sees her first, and since she can't believe it, she asks me to verify. It's not easy because we don't want to get caught. The restaurant is sufficiently dark, and it has a series of meandering nooks and alcoves. It's a great place to hide and have a meal without seeing many people. As Naomi returns from the ladies' room, she sees three booths in the rear of a dining room. Seated in one of them, side by side and deep in conversation, are Judith and another woman. Not Eva, the current partner, but someone else. A curtain of beads is partially closed at the booth and blocking some of the view, but she is certain it's Judith. Common sense would say that the two women, if only friends or associates or colleagues, would be sitting across the table from each other. But these two women are shoulder to shoulder and lost in another world, according to Naomi. I sneak around to the men's room and see what I desperately want to see. I hustle back to the table and confirm it all with Naomi. I consider leaving and avoiding an embarrassing situation. We don't want Judith to see us, and I'm absolutely certain she doesn't want us to see her. I consider sending Naomi to the car, then crashing Judith's little rendezvous. How cool it would be to watch her melt and start lying. I'll ask about Eva. Send my regards. I consider Starcher and what this might mean in the war being waged by his biological parents. His mothers aren't legally married, so I suppose it's okay for one or both to see other women, though I seriously doubt they have an open relationship. How am I supposed to know the rules? But if Eva finds out, there will be even more warfare, more grief for the kid, and more ammunition for me. I consider calling partner and getting him to follow Judith, maybe take some photos. As I consider all of this and sip a whiskey sour, Judith appears from around the corner and walks straight to our table. In the distance, I see her friend leave hurriedly through the front door, one last furtive tell-all glance over her shoulder. Judith, in full bitch mode, says, "Well, well, didn't expect to see you here." I'm not about to allow her to intimidate Naomi, who's temporarily stricken. I say, "Didn't expect to see you either. Here alone?" "Yes," she says, "just picking up some takeout." "Oh, really? Then who's the girl?" "What girl?" "The girl in the booth, short sandy hair buzzed on one side in the current fad. The girl who just broke her neck getting out of the front door. Does Eva know about her?" "Oh, that girl. She's just a friend. Does the school allow its teachers to date its parents?" "It's frowned upon but not prohibited," Naomi says coolly. "Does Eva allow you to date other people?" I ask. "Wasn't a date. She's just a friend." Then why did you just lie about her? Why did you lie about the takeout? She ignores me and glares at Naomi. I guess I should report this to the school. Go ahead, I say. I'll report it to Ava. Is she keeping Starcher while you're out fooling around? I'm not fooling around, and my son is none of your business right now. You blew it last weekend. A little Thai guy in a suit eases over and with a big smile asks, Everything okay here? Yes, she's just leaving, I say. I look at Judith. Please, we're trying to order. See you in court, she hisses and turns on her heels. I watch her leave, and she does not take any food with her. The little Thai guy slides away, still smiling. We drink our drinks and eventually look at the menus. After a few minutes, I say, Our secret is safe. She won't say anything to the school because she knows I'll call Ava. You'd really do that? In the blink of an eye, this is a war. There are no rules, Naomi, no thoughts of fighting fair. Do you want custody of Starcher? No, I'm not a good enough father, but I do want to remain relevant in his life. Who knows? One day he and I might be friends. Chapter 29. The last witness for the defense is the defendant himself. Before he is called on Monday morning, I hand the judge and the prosecutor a letter I've written to Tadeo Zapata. Its purpose is to inform him in writing that he is testifying against the advice of his attorney. I grilled him for 2 hours the day before, and he thinks he's ready. He swears to tell the truth, smiles nervously at the jury, and immediately learns the frightful lesson that the view from the witness stand is quite intimidating. Everyone is gawking and waiting to hear what he might possibly say in his defense. A court reporter will record every word. The judge is scowling down as if she's ready for a quick reprimand. The prosecutor is eager to pounce. I walk him through his background, family, education, employment, lack of criminal record, boxing career, and his success in mixed martial arts. Sticking to our script, we talk about the fight, and he does an adequate job of describing what it was like getting hit so many times. He and I know that Crush did not land many serious blows, but no one on the jury understands this. He tells the jury he doesn't remember the end of the fight, but can recollect a fuzzy image of his opponent raising his arms in a victory that he didn't deserve. Yes, he snapped, though he can't really recall everything. He was overwhelmed by a sense of injustice. His career was gone, stolen. He vaguely remembers the referee raising Crush's arm. Then everything went black. The next thing he remembered, he was in the dressing room, and two cops were watching him. He asked the cops who won the fight, and one of them said, Which fight? They put handcuffs on him and explained he was under arrest for aggravated assault. He was baffled by this, couldn't believe what was happening. At the jail, another cop told him Sean King was in critical condition. He, Tadeo, began crying. Even today, he still can't believe it. His voice cracks a bit, and he wipes something from his left eye. He's not a very good actor. As I sit down, Mancini bounces to his feet and calls out the first question, So, Mr. Zapata, how many times have you gone insane? It's a brilliant opening, a great line delivered with just enough sarcasm. He proceeds to make a fool out of Tadeo. When was the first time you went insane? How long did it last? Anybody get hurt the first time? Do you always black out when you go insane? Have you seen a doctor for your insanity? No? Why not? Since you attacked Sean King, have you been evaluated by a doctor, one not connected to this trial? Does insanity run in your family? After 30 minutes of this assault, the word insanity means nothing. It's a joke. Tadeo works hard to stay cool, but he can't help himself. Mancini is practically laughing at him. The jurors seem amused. Max asks about his record as an amateur boxer. 24 wins, 7 losses, Max says. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but 5 years ago, when you were 17 and fighting in the Golden Gloves District Tournament, you lost a split decision to a man named Corliss Bean. That right? Yes. Very tough fight, right? Yes. Were you upset by the decision? I didn't like it, thought it was wrong, thought I won the fight. Did you go insane? No. Did you black out? No. Did you in any way voice your frustration with the decision? I don't think so. Well, do you remember it, or did you lose your memory again? I remember it. While you were still in the ring, did you hit anybody? Tadeo shoots me a guilty look that betrays him, but says, no. Mancini takes a deep breath, shakes his head as if he hates to do what he's about to do, and says, Your Honor, I have another bit of video that I think might help us here. It's the end of the fight 5 years ago with Corliss Bean. I stand and say, Your Honor, I know nothing about this. It was not disclosed to me. Max is ready because he's been planning this ambush for weeks. He says with great confidence, Your Honor, it wasn't disclosed because that was not required. The state is not offering the video as proof of this defendant's guilt. Therefore, under our Rule 92F, there's no disclosure. Rather, the state is offering the video to challenge the credibility of this witness. Well, could I at least see it first before the jury sees it, I ask slowly. That sounds reasonable, Go Slow responds. Let's take a 15-minute recess. In chambers, we watch the video, Tadeo and Corliss Bean in the center of the ring with the ref who raises Bean's right hand in victory. Tadeo yanks away from the ref, walks to his corner, yelling something in an angry fit. He stomps around the ring, becoming more unhinged with each second. He walks to the ropes, screams at the judges, and inadvertently bumps into Corliss Bean, who's minding his own business and savoring the win. Others are in the ring, and someone starts pushing. The ref steps between the two fighters, and Tadeo shoves him. The ref, a big guy, shoves back. For a second, it looks as though the ring is on the verge of chaos, but someone grabs Tadeo and pulls him away, kicking and screaming. Again, the camera doesn't lie. Tadeo looks like a sore loser, a hothead, a brat, a dangerous man who doesn't care if he starts a brawl. Go Slow says, Looks relevant to me. Chapter 30. I watch the jurors as they watch the video. Several shake their heads. When it's over, the lights come up, and Max gleefully returns to the mock insanity crap and hammers away. Tadeo's credibility is thoroughly trashed. I cannot resurrect him on redirect. The defense rests. Mancini calls his first rebuttal witness, a shrink named Wafer. He works for the state mental health department and has credentials that cannot be questioned. He's not the brilliant expert from afar like Tazelman, but he's quite effective. He's watched the video, all of the videos, and he spent 6 hours with the defendant, more time than Tazelman. I haggle with Wafer until noon, but score little. As we're breaking for lunch, Mancini grabs me and asks, Can I talk to your client? About what? The deal, man. Sure. We step to the defense table where Tadeo is sitting. Max leans down and says in a low voice, Look, dude, I'm still offering 5 years, which means 18 months. Manslaughter. If you say no, you really are insane because you're about to get 20 years. Tadeo seems to ignore him. He just smiles, shakes his head no. He's even more confident now because Miguel has found the cash and delivered the envelope to Suarez. This I will learn only after it's too late. Chapter 31. After lunch, we meet in chambers, where Go Slow has on display a plastic plate covered with sliced carrots and celery, as if we're interrupting her meal. I suspect it's all for show. She asks, Mr. Rudd, what about the plea bargain? I understand the deal is still on the table. I shrug and say, Yes, Judge, I have discussed it with my client, as has Mr. Mancini. The kid won't budge. She says, Okay, we're off the record here. Now that I've seen the evidence, I'm leaning toward a longer sentence, something like 20 years. I didn't buy the insanity stuff, neither did the jury. It was a vicious attack, and he knew exactly what he was doing. I think 20 years is appropriate. May I pass this along to my client, off the record, of course? Please do. She drowns some celery in table salt, looks at Mancini, and asks, What's next? Max says, I have just one more witness, Dr. Lewandowski, but I'm not sure we need him. What do you think, Judge? Your call, but I think the jury is ready. Mr. Rudd? You're asking me? Oh, why not, Max says. Put yourself in my shoes and make the call. Well, Lewandowski is just going to repeat what Wafer said. I think Wafer is a far better witness. I'd leave it at that. Max says, I think you're right. We'll rest. During Max's closing argument, I keep glancing at Esteban Suarez, who seems to be thoroughly captivated by his feet. He's withdrawn into a cocoon and appears to hear nothing. Something has changed with this guy, and for a second I wonder if Miguel has managed to get to him. If not with cash, then with threats, intimidation. Maybe he's promised a few pounds of cocaine. Max does a nice job of recapping the case. Mercifully, he does not show the damn video again. He drives home the undeniable point that Tadeo might not have planned his deadly assault on Sean King, but he clearly intended to inflict severe physical injury. He didn't intend to kill the referee, but in fact he did. He could have thrown one punch or two and stopped, guilty of assault, but no major crime. But no, 22 vicious shots to the head of a man who could not defend himself, 22 blows delivered by a highly trained fighter whose admitted goal was to see every opponent leave the ring on a stretcher. Well, he achieved his goal. Sean King left on a stretcher and never woke up. Max fights off the natural prosecutorial tendency to beat the drum too long. He's got the jury, and he can sense it. I think everybody senses it, perhaps with the exception of my client. I begin by saying that Tadeo Zapata is not a murderer. He's lived on the streets. He's seen it all and wants no part of it. That's why his record is spotless. No history of violence outside the ring. I pace back and forth in front of the jury box, looking at each juror, trying to connect. I play for sympathy and touch slightly on the issue of insanity. I ask the jury for a not guilty verdict or, in the alternative, manslaughter. When I return to the defense table, Tadeo has moved his chair as far away from mine as he possibly can. Judge Fabino instructs the jurors, and they retire at 3 p.m. The waiting begins. I ask a bailiff if Tadeo can visit with his family in the courtroom while the jury is out. He confers with his colleagues, and they reluctantly agree. Tadeo steps through the bar and takes a seat on the front bench. His mother, a sister, and some nieces and nephews gather around him, and everybody has a good cry. Mrs. Zapata has not physically touched her son in many months, and she can't keep her hands off of him. I leave the courtroom, find partner, and head for a coffee bar down the street. Chapter 32. At 5:15, the jurors file back into the courtroom, and there's not a single smile among them. The foreman hands the verdict to a bailiff who hands it to the judge. She reads it very slowly and ask the defendant to please stand. I stand with him. She clears her throat and reads, We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of second-degree murder in the death of Sean King. Tadeo utters a soft groan and drops his head. Someone in the Zapata clan gasps from the back row. We sit down as the judge polls the jurors. One by one, all guilty, unanimous. She congratulates them on a fine job, tells them their checks for the jury duty will be in the mail, and dismisses them. When they're gone, she sets deadlines for post-trial motions and such, and gives a date a month from now for sentencing. I scribble this down and ignore my client. Bailiffs surround him and slap on handcuffs. He leaves without a word. As the courtroom thins out, the Zapata family makes a slow exit. Miguel has his arm around his mother, who is distraught. Once they're outside in the hallway and within clear view of some reporters and TV cameras, three cops in suits grab Miguel and tell him he's under arrest. Obstruction of justice, bribery, and jury tampering. Suarez was indeed wearing a wire. Chapter 33. Since I lost, I avoid the reporters. My phone is buzzing, so I turn it off. partner and I go to a dark bar to lick our wounds. I knock back almost an entire pint of ale before either of us speaks. He starts with, "Say, boss, how close did you come to bribing Suarez?" I thought about it. I know you did, I could tell. But something wasn't right. Plus, Mancini was playing it straight, not cheating. When the good guy starts cheating, then I have no choice, but Mancini didn't have to. We tried a clean case, which is unusual. I finish the pint and order another. Partner's had two sips of his. Miss Luella frowns on drinking and will say something if she smells it. "What happens to Miguel?" he asks. "Looks like he'll be spending time with his brother. You going to defend him?" "Hell no, I'm sick of the Zapata boys." "You think he'll sing about Link's thugs?" "I doubt it. He's in enough trouble as it is. A couple of murders won't help him much." We order a basket of fries and call it dinner. After we leave the bar, I keep the van and drop partner off at his apartment. I finally go home, and the place feels cold and lonely. I change into jeans and walk down to the rack, where I drink a beer, smoke a cigar, and shoot 8-ball for 2 hours, all alone. At 10, I check my phone. Every Zapata in town is looking for me. Seems they need me now. I'm fed up with these people, but I know they're not going away. Two reporters are calling. Mancini wants to have a drink. Why, I have no idea. And there's a voicemail from Arch Swanger. Condolences on the big loss. How in hell? I need to leave town. At midnight, I load the van with some clothes, the golf clubs, and half a case of small batch bourbon. I flip a coin. Head north. I stop at a budget motel and pay $40 for one night. I'll be on a golf course somewhere by noon, all alone. This time, I'm not sure I'm coming back. And that concludes Rogue Lawyer by John Grisham, published by Doubleday of New York in 2015. And this is the final episode of The Radio Reader. Here now is Dick Estelle.
This is Dick Estelle on my last day of broadcast. Please permit me to express my gratitude to all of my listeners and their support over the last 50-plus years. It's with a heavy heart that I must say goodbye to all of you at this difficult time. I wish I could send each one of you a personal thank you, but time does not permit. Without all of your faithful support throughout my career, I would never have been able to keep my dream job for as long as I did. So I thank you from the deepest part of my soul. And on a personal note, I especially thank Hal Prentice, Scott Seaman, Bob Page, Paul Brown, the McDougals, the innkeeper, Miss Lily, Wenda Parks, the Thorntons, the mountain climber, Matt Sorrell, and my family. If you feel I have touched your life in any way over the past half century, I'm asking you please do the same for me. Send me a note or a card to get me through my final days. Emails are not good for me any longer, but handwritten cards and notes will mean everything to me. With gratitude for allowing me to be part of your lives for the past 50 years, and with much love, this is your radio reader, Dick Estelle. Goodbye.